Tom's presenter notes. See if it likes that. Really doesn't like that, does it? Alright, what's your resolution for this thing? That it would shrink past
your right. No soup for you.
Alright. That's our for next week, to keep giving you the primary.
Nope.
I've never seen anything like this. It's quite a conundrum. Alright, mirror displays. This is nuts. What else are you running?
You can close, like, mail.
Whoa! Yeah, that would help.
Oh, good lord.
You can rip out the external if you want to see it.
Guess I will just cancel these. Yeah, some of these might be sensitive. Come on, mail. Guess I'll save these.
Jesus. Emails? 8,000. I thought I had a lot.
Ram, no, I was just being facetious when I said wait for me.
Oh.
Complaining about video RAM.
Video RAM.
Yeah. You have a shared video RAM with your sister RAM? Well, if it's shared, that might explain it. Here. Put that out so you can do that. Try a reboot just to see.
No.
You don't want to reboot?
No.
Too many things running?
Yes.
Yeah, I know the feeling. Let me see activity monitor. Okay, you've got free 200 meg, wired, active, inactive. That's it. I've only got 2 gig total. Ouch. Can I close Safari?
No.
No? Okay. Safari eats up a lot.
Yeah.
Excusing.
Yeah.
Good portion of it. Oh, God.
Alternative? Export to USB, export to a PDF.
PDF?
Yeah.
And record off the other side.
Actually, you can just
plug it in that.
You know what? Let me revert my change to 200. And print a PDF, you can just use a preview.
You
do
should
a full screen.
Save that first before you. I guess it doesn't matter.
I just undid my change to 800 by 600. Ducky. Wait. Oh, yeah. Ducky, sure. Okay. Yeah, I know. It's the greatest feature ever.
And now that OpenOffice does it?
Which one is it? I don't know where it's saved. I went default. That's the one? Oh, it's trying to print presenter notes. Try export instead of preview. Or print.
Yeah.
You gotta go in Keynote.
Thanks.
I hope you've all brought cash for the auction in the closing session. It'll be very good swag. We have to beat BSD CAN, who raised $875.
There we go.
We'll be competing bids for an item. I'll probably split up one half of the room from the other half of the room. You can bid against
click
each
on the
other
desktop
on a particular item that we'll have up. All the money goes to charity.
There you go. All right. All right, I'm going to get you onto the green screen. Once it detects, I'll put it on mine, start the recording, and I'll let you go. You have both microphones?
Yep.
Found it. All right.
That's potentially troublesome. All right. So if you ever meet someone that says, like, oh, I went to that talk, or I didn't go to the talk, but I saw the video online, then you can punch them, because you had to sit through that to get their video. And the slides are going to have special effects, apparently. So again... There will be a video after this that won't be as awesome. So there's both negative but also good upside as well. So, yes, sir?
Thank you.
Okay. Mood lighting and special effects. We're good? All right. So, check, please. Hopefully you're in the right talk, because now you can't actually leave and catch the other talks at the beginning. So we're going to talk about some stuff that... generally, you should be monitoring in some way. If you're running Postgres, which I assume most of you are, or if you're responsible for it being up, or you just like to check if the DBA who's supposed to do that is doing his job correctly, these are some things that you should be aware of. All right. All right, so who am I? Which is more about where did all this stuff come from. I lead the database operations at OmniTI. We are yet another database consulting and management company. Probably one of the things that I think is different about us on some level is that we do focus quite a bit on the management side of things, meaning we are, for our clients, we do a lot of the actual day-to-day maintenance, running things. When something breaks, you know, somebody doesn't call us necessarily, we get a page from the machines that go down, which is probably more like what most DBAs go through on a daily basis. So we do consulting work, but... that sort of day-to-day grind of things, as I like to say, it keeps us honest on some level, right? Because we're in there, and we need to make sure we know what's going on. We do database stuff in general. Most of it focuses on Postgres, which is kind of why I'm here. The instances that we run kind of spans the entire range of databases. The ones that everyone gets excited about are we have a few terabyte-plus instances that we run, I guess multi-terabyte, that are sort of OLAP or DSS-oriented systems. We also do OLTP stuff, like the multiple thousand transaction per second type things. So we run in some pretty beefy environments where it is at least a challenge to keep things up and running. We also do a little work on like custom-built private label Postgres instances for people that want to like bundle Postgres as part of their application. So there's a different dynamic there when they're not going to have hands-on monitoring, but they need to have an idea of what's going on with their systems. So I've also been using Postgres for a long time. I started back, I think, on 6.5. And I'm currently also running like 9s in production. So I've probably run just about every version since the 6.5 in production in some level. So I'm a community member, like many people here, for a long time. Also now, I guess I'm considered a major contributor, which I'm not sure what that means, but it sounds good, so I said it. So taking all of that knowledge, having run all these different types of systems, and sort of bundling that up in, here's some sort of critical things that when we go in and we look at other people's systems, we know that they're not looking at, or people aren't necessarily aware that they should be looking at, right? And that's what we hope to focus on today. All right. So one thing we're not really going to talk about a lot, but it is important, is the idea of tuning your database, right? For all the alerting and trending that you do, that's sort of half the puzzle. You should also do basic tuning and probably do that first before you worry about trending and alerting, right? Because if you haven't done the basics on the tuning side, then this stuff is more, you know, how do I project for the future? How do I optimize what I have? Basic tuning gets you, like, over that first hurdle, right? And if you haven't done that, you're shooting yourself in the foot more than you need to be anyways. There's a few good resources out. I threw up links to the ones that I generally recommend to people. Shared buffers, effective cache size, and checkpoints seem to be the ones that are mysterious to people or that they leave as defaults. So those are the three big ones that I normally say you've got to have mentioned these or gone through and looked at your conf and changed. But there's a few other ones that are worth looking at. Links there. Go through that stuff first before you really get worried about doing trending. If you don't do that and you start trending now, you'll definitely see, you know, pretty wide variations in your graphs that will almost be anomalies, right? Because performance will have been potentially so bad early on before you've tuned that it won't really compare to what you're going to be doing going forward, right? So tuning job one. So part of what we're doing here, when I talk about things that you need to be checking, there's two halves to that, right? The first half is actually monitoring systems. And this is the classic idea with the pager, right? You're going to have something that's looking at the database continuously. When you see a problem, it sends an alert to somebody, probably to a pager or into some type of system like that. People build a lot of different systems around that, you know, trying to keep track of what's going on. I know a lot of ops nerds, they're like, hey, I want like the big screen in my office that everyone can look at, and it flashes red when something goes bad. Whatever floats your boat in that direction is cool with me, right? It's more about what you monitor, not how you determine you need to get the message. The thing that we've sort of found is that monitoring definitely is important in the sense that we've seen cases where, you know, you can have like C code loaded into Postgres that will occasionally crash a backend, but Postgres will just restart when that happens, right? And sometimes that restart is like less than 30 seconds of downtime. And if you don't have some type of monitoring system in place, and you're not really paying attention to that stuff, you can have sort of intermittent outages that you're not aware of, right? So that's sort of the make sure you're keeping an eye on this stuff. Special effects. Make sure you're keeping an eye on this stuff to sort of root those problems out, right? The other philosophy that we have in general is that pain is a pretty good motivator of things, right? If things are breaking in the middle of the night, but when you come in the morning, it's actually working, then honestly, most people won't care. However, if they're getting a page in the middle of the night and it's waking them up and then they have to fix something, then they're much more likely to care, right? And so that sort of dovetails in. When you're monitoring stuff, you also can motivate people to actually fix things that are going wrong that they might not otherwise care about. So trending being the other half of this, right? So it's good to get alerts, and that's definitely helpful for dealing with immediate problems. But when you start talking about capacity planning and being able to do future growth or looking back to see what's the evolution of a problem that has started, you really need to be doing trending for that information, right? The example here is just a graph out of Circona system where, right, they're trending some information and they can go back and look and see, like, we had something working like this and here's where we fixed it, and you instantly see the drop, right? That archive of information and being able to do projections or to root out problems from that, definitely useful and definitely critical as you start getting into more and more systems. If you talk to, you know, any of the sort of large-scale, famous-oriented companies that are doing this, like My Yearbook or Etsy or Filius, they all have, you know, good trending going on. Maybe not always as good, depending on who you're talking to within the teams, but they definitely have some type of trending solution in place. And it's, I think, more overlooked than the monitoring stuff, right? People usually will have like a Nagio setup, but they don't think about how do we draw graphs and how do we project this stuff over time. So I try to emphasize that because I think it's usually relegated to the back seat, and I find it to be just as important if you're going to be doing long scale work on a database. So tools, I'm not really, I guess I don't have a strong proponent of any one particular tool. I'm more of a, I know the things that I need to be looking at, and I don't care how I look at them or what tool that is being used for that, as long as I can get the information that I need, right? There are some tools out there that I know you can install, and they claim you install this, you point it at Postgres, and we will tell you when anything goes wrong, right? And those are the ones that I'm always leery of, because a lot of this stuff is dependent on the type of workload that you have, or you know the version of Postgres you're running, or things like that. So I tend to think if you're looking for that type of a solution, there aren't really any good ones out there, and I would get nervous if that's the direction you're heading. That's just me. I find getting experience or learning from others or you know just being on the mailing list or whatever, it doesn't have to be firsthand knowledge, but following along the problems that other people have is a way to get that experience and understand the things that you should be looking for, right? What tools do help you do, though, is they help you maintain the discipline that you need to go ahead and fix things in the, that are breaking in the middle of the night, right? To make sure that you're projecting things out before they crash on you and things like that. So a few popular tools, probably most of you have heard of some of these. Nagios is, I think, the most famous alerting system as far as the people that we've talked to, but it's basically, it monitors stuff and sends pages out like that. If you want to do trending and graphs, Cacti and MRTG are two of the more popular ones. There's a host of other ones, and I only pick these because most people have heard of them. Or if you Google on them, you'll get a lot of results. Right? So if you want to learn more about these types of systems, these are the obvious ones that most people use. I'm honestly not a big fan of either Nagios or Cacti, but they're both pretty popular. So similar systems like that. There's another one that we've helped develop, which is sort of Circonus.com is the commercial version, Reconnoiter being the open source project. It's a combined solution where it does both trending and alerting. So that's another route you can go. You'll find that a lot of things we're going to discuss, you need to both alert and do trending on, right? So if you use Nagios and Cacti, we definitely do that with a lot of our customers, and that'll work fine, but you have to have two systems set up. So the other option is try to find a system that'll do both. The final tool that I mentioned here is probably the most directly related to Postgres in the DBA shop, which is a script called Check Postgres. If you Google on that, you should find it in the first hit. It's basically this really large Perl script that has a whole bunch of things that people that have been doing DBA work for the last few years, you know, have collected up and said, these are the things that we need to check. It interfaces with Nagios and I think Munin, and I think it can do MRTG graphs as well. It has enough of a pluggable interface. If you're using something else, you can probably get the input out of Check Postgres and into that. The other thing I always recommend is if you have your own system and you want to write your own checks, go look at the Check Postgres stuff. You'll see the SQL that it's building to try and do the checks, and you can steal that out of Check Postgres and write it into your own system. I've definitely done that in the past. So it's open source, BSD licensed, always likes contributors. It's multilingual, so it's... As far as I would say, it's the best like Postgres-specific tool. Anyone that's monitoring stuff should at least go look at that, even if they don't want to implement with it directly. So, some stuff to look at. Some of these seem fairly obvious, and hopefully they won't be too mysterious. Uh-oh. I'm just going to... Yeah, see? Fail. Oh, we'll never get there now. Yes. Hold on. We're back here. Hold on. We'll see. Go.
Just try turning it off and on.
There we go. Yeah, reboot. No, we're still there. Let's. Hey, we can make it worse. Awesome.
it's cutting off the left.
Yeah. Well, you'll get to see all the nice pictures, which is good. That's more important than the text, right? Well.
You could just zoom out, we can preview. If you just exit the full screen mode and you just zoom out, you can do a command minus. You can maybe make it fit.
That's close enough. How do I go back? How do I get back?
Command zero, command plus.
No. There you go. No, I want to go back a few slides. Yeah, that's obviously not working. Because that's that being the obvious thing to do. So. Oh, there we go.
You're going back now.
And we're done. No. All right. We can almost see everything. No, that's close enough. There's nothing really awesome in the half inch that's off the screen. So so connections is kind of the first obvious thing that people think of when you start talking about what you should monitor, right? There's a hard limit on connections in Postgres. When you reach that, it's basically game over, right? You can't get any more connections in, your website shuts down or whatever, and it's basically game over, right? You all may have heard of popular internet services that have this problem. I won't mention any by name. You can determine your own choice of that. But the thing that's important to think about with connections is not only do you need to be aware, right? You need to get sort of the page. This one, probably you don't need an alert, because if you do hit this limit and you're getting, you know, fatal errors because people can't connect, somebody will call you even if you don't have a system in place. But the other half of that is this is a good thing to trend, right? If you watch connection growth and the cycles that you might have for spikes during the day and that kind of thing, you're definitely better able to do capacity planning or start to realize when do I need to start putting, like, you know, connection pooling either in my app or using something like PG Bouncer. And you can plan for that stuff before you start getting fail whales all over the place, right? I tend to think this is everybody's problem. It's more so for people that, you know, have a large number of concurrent users. Internet-facing systems, which is not to mean your database is on the internet, but if you provide a web service that's on the internet where you can't really regulate traffic, you're more likely to have this kind of problem. The other part being that, if you remember, you have to restart the server to change the connection limit, so that's the other part of planning ahead, right? If you're trending that stuff and you're getting close to your peaks, you may know that, one, connection pooling, yes, but perhaps restarting and putting a higher limit, also an option there, right? So perhaps on your small intranet or some system where you know a pretty fixed number of users, maybe it wouldn't be so important. I would still recommend trending it, and I would trend not only total number of connections, but active connections versus idle connections. Make sure that you're keeping track of both of those. Okay. Disk space, another fairly obvious thing that most people look at. It gets a little trickier depending on the size and the scope of the systems that you're setting up. Everyone always realizes, right, I only have so much disk space, and eventually I can run out. When you start to do things like partitioning, or you're setting up servers and you're putting Xlogs on a different set of disks, I've seen places where people, you know, had the original monitor set up that the sysops guys did, and they're checking for disk space, then they move Xlogs off to another, you know, another set of disks, and they forget to put a monitor on that, which seems odd, but it happens. You know, you've got to make sure that you monitor everything where your disk could be writing out, right? Log files are another one that people don't really think about. In Postgres, if you're using the default logging system, most people do not set that up in a way that will be self-maintaining. It will grow on and on and on forever. I've seen people run out of disk space, even though they don't think they're generating that much data. They end up generating log files and get themselves into trouble, right? Again, this is a good one to alert on. Most people usually have alerts like this. You want to make sure you set it, you know, at some level of, I can project how long I'm going to have as a response before I run out of disk. And there's different tricks to that. If your problem is log files, you know, that's easy because you decide that the logs from 3 years ago, you can just delete. If it's Xlogs or Clog, well, don't ever delete the Clog. That's rule number one. I wouldn't delete the Xlogs either. But you may have other tricks that you need to come up with in those scenarios, right? So plan to make sure that you're getting an alert with enough time to respond to having an out-of-disk problem, right? Again, if you run out of space, It's pretty close to game over. Postgres actually runs pretty well if you're doing read-only stuff with no disk space, and don't ask how I know that. If it crashes, you probably will be able to bring it back up without too much trouble. That's, you know, it's nice that it's fairly robust. Again, the other half of this is just like connections. You want to trend this because you want to do capacity planning. Make sure that you're either buying larger disks or, you know, get compression on your disks or whatever tricks that you want to play, but that you're keeping track of that ahead of time. The other half of that planning is also, you know, disk space is good, but also keep in mind, like, how much RAM do you have in the machine versus how much space are you using on disk? When you start to get to a point where, like, temp files are being written to disk and they're no longer in RAM, right, as your database grows, those are other things to think about where you'll see disk usage start going up. So, again, I think this affects everybody. You probably should alert on it. You probably should trend on it. It's a pretty common thing, right? And most systems are pretty good about having connection monitors, having disk space monitors. Just be aware that as you start to get more complicated configurations, you may need to do a few extra steps to make sure things are okay. So wall files. This one is probably going to get more interesting as we get into 9, but the basic idea here is that if you look in your Postgres data directory, you have a directory called pgxlog, right? And these are where the transaction logs get written. And there's some configuration settings that will control how many you should have in this. But the primary thing that will be a main factor is how much write activity you have going on. The more write activity, probably the larger you're going to want to set the settings, so the more disk space you're going to need to have those files, right? They're definitely critical. You have to maintain database consistency, and this is what is used for that. Certainly in the case of a crash, you know, it can be a problem. The things that you'll have to be aware of, right, is one, excessive disk space being chewed up by the creation of Xlog segments. If you have a storm of updates, you actually can start pushing these out really quickly, and that can cause a problem. The other half is excessive recovery time, right? The more Xlogs you have in the event of a crash, the longer it will take to bring your database back up, right? We do alerts on this. We also trend this in a lot of systems. We've been bitten in a few cases, and it's debatable whether this was a Postgres issue or something else, but cases where if you're doing like PG start backup or stop backup, or if you start doing like streaming replication, we're going to see how much this starts biting people. There are scenarios where Postgres won't automatically recycle these Xlogs, right? They will start building up on the master. And so it becomes pretty critical to say, you know, whether these are on your main disk or they're on some other set of disks, if you're building these up beyond what you thought you would have it configured for, you know, alerts need to go off, or you need to have graphs on this to make sure, you know, eventually you can run out of disk space or cause issues with recovery time. Right. So another key thing that you need to be checking out. Going back to, yes, go ahead, Michael.
Are you going to go into later on the specifics on how you can track these things individually?
Maybe yes, maybe no. Depends.
This is something we run into in particular with the wall log file.
Sure.
Something that I had forgotten about was the ability for you, through the SQL interface, to go in and look at what files are under Postgres directory, which includes being able to receive counts of you can actually LS directories under,
right,
under the data directory.
Yeah. Right, and that's what I would say. So going back to check Postgres being my general tool of pointing people at, if you go look in there, I've worked on that check, and it's basically what you're saying. There's a check in there for wall files. And I would say for most of these, go look in there, because there's probably something very close to this, and you can see the exact SQL that you need to run. Right, you can query from outside the database to look and see how many wall files you've generated. And then I believe, if I remember the way that code works, if it's still the same way, generally, we know how many Xlog files you should have, right? It's a factor of how many checkpoint segments you've set up. So if you find a large discrepancy, like you've gone over that, like twice that number, probably something is wrong in your system and somebody should take a look, right? Most of these, I would say, your best resource is probably to look and check Postgres first, because it's the most comprehensive solution, and I know it's been tested on multiple versions. We run it and a bunch of other people run it. So that's the best source for finding this type of information, because you don't have to figure out the queries. Like, it's just in there. So, size. Similar to disk space, but on a slightly different level, it's important to project growth and to track that over time, right? Obviously, more data is more disk space, and that's important. But the other half of that is some people generally think they have an idea of how fast they should be growing. Changes in application can definitely make a change in your data growth rate. If you're not doing something to keep an eye on that, it's pretty hard to notice until you get to the out of disk space scenario. And ideally, you'd see it beforehand. Even in systems where you don't think out of disk space is an issue, there can be issues with table growth size or database size, right? You're going to eventually start slowing down different processes, right? You may have a backup process that runs in 10 minutes, and then suddenly some table starts to double and triple in size in a way that you hadn't really planned for. Now your backups can take much longer, right? So there'll be other systems that might be affected. We had one scenario where we were running a Rails system, and someone had flipped a bit, for lack of a better term, to do session management inside the database. And the way that Rails was handling that wasn't cleaning up sessions after they were done with, right? So suddenly there was a table in that database that was just growing astronomically high for everyone that was logging in. I think that database was probably should have been around 1 gigabyte, and we just happened to notice one day that the database was like 8 gigabytes, right? And it was all basically this one table, which we could basically just truncate when we found out. But it was sort of unnerving that, you know, here's people, they're running their system and they're doing stuff, and some guy makes a quick application change, and suddenly we have 8 times the size of the database, right? It's like, that's the kind of thing that I get worried about. Especially, and I'll go back to, you know, web-facing stuff where you're not necessarily in control of how fast data is going to grow. Those are scenarios where you can plan and you can sort of think you have an idea how fast you can grow, but if you're not actually monitoring that, if you're not trending that information, you don't really have a good way to verify that, right? It's definitely easier to just be able to go and look at a graph every day and say, oh yeah, we're fine, right? Fast-paced development shops is where I find this to be the biggest issue, because there's less planning involved with features that they're going to roll out, right? They don't really take the time to think about how this will affect capacity going forward. You're just kind of rolling out the new features. Everyone else, probably this could bite eventually. So, and this also, I'll say again, it doubles into like how much RAM do you have. If your database is currently in RAM, how long before you're not in that scenario? Right, and there's a whole host of other issues there. Check Postgres has one of these. You basically just look at the size of your data. You can do that from the file system. You can do that inside Postgres. There's a PG database size command that will give you that information. How you collect the information isn't as important as, you know, making sure that you are. So, and I would say do it both on the database level, but also watch critical tables, right, to make sure that they're growing in the manner that you expect. Bloating. How many people have suffered from like table bloat or index bloat? Right. Okay, it's a pretty common problem. One of the things that's really annoying about this, though, is it's not an obvious problem, right? Usually until you have a performance issue, and then you go and look. For some people, they get lucky, where they know index bloat is a constant problem, and so they just deal with it on a regular basis for some version of luck. But for a lot of people, you know, this is something that builds up over time, and eventually it bites you. And the problem being that it can be pretty expensive from a, you know, services point of view to actually clean that up, right? Often is heavy locking, often a lot of data rewriting. So keeping an eye on that ahead of time is a good thing. There's a check in Check Postgres, so you can do alerts on this. I tend to find that I don't need to know that badly, right? I try to keep alerts to things that I find critical. We ripped out the code from Check Postgres and made a Perl script that would go and check this and send us like an email report of what's bloated, right? So if we think there's table bloat in a system, we just run this and it gives us a report on what's bloated. Basically, the way that most of these systems try to do it, there's some that are smarter than others, but they basically will look at the columns in a system, in a table, right? Compute up how large they think that should be, you know, times the number of rows in the table, and then how big is the table actually. And, you know, if it's really big, then you figure you have table bloat. If you're using PG Free Space Map and you're in like 8.3 or older, you can get much better ideas of how much table bloat you have. Once you're in 8.4, I guess you can still use that to figure out table bloat, but I've found that the dumb way actually seems to be just about as good. So, again, bloating is I/O issues if you don't, you know, keep on top of it. It can lead to disk space issues eventually. We definitely run into people that have called us and said, you know, we're on the side of disk space and like something's definitely wrong, and we go look and it's just table bloat, right? They've not configured things correctly, they turned auto vacuum off or something like that. And you'll go look and figure out like, well, this table, you know, should be 3 megs and it's like 300. So again, heavy updates and data churn are the classic cases where you run into this problem. If you're doing that type of work, you need to be on top of this. If you're insert only, without a lot of failed inserts, then you're probably okay in this case. Doing a lot of select-oriented work where you have really low updates, probably not a lot of data churn, so then you're probably okay. I wouldn't say that you shouldn't watch this, but it will probably be less critical for you. Definitely if you're on an untuned system, and usually untuned means something in regards to auto vacuum or the free space map settings on 8.3 or older, those are where you often see this a lot. Transactions. So in Postgres, every statement that you run is a transaction, right? Sort of throws people off. Even if you do a select statement, it's considered a transaction against your system. You know, inserts, updates, and deletes, obviously, transactions. Keeping track of the number of transactions, like I always tell people, if for no other reason, you can go to a conference and say you do like 1,000 transactions per second, and maybe that gets you something, you know, some street cred or whatever. But it's also definitely good for like capacity planning, and making sure, you know, looking for traffic spikes and being able to figure out where things are going wrong. It's sort of underlying effects that can happen, right, when you're not keeping an eye on how many transactions you're running. OLTP is where this really usually shows up because there's enough dynamic stuff going on where transactions really matter. If you're doing like data warehousing, you just usually don't have that many transactions going on. They're really long, they're really big, but there's not that many of them. I don't think we ever page on this. This is more of a strictly just trend this over time. And especially if you're doing, you know, a lot of deployment on your application, keep a good eye on this because we found that, you know, again, it's one of those, the more rapid you do development, the less sort of forethought is being put into these features being rolled out. So being able to go back and look and say, oh, you know, 2 weeks ago there was a large spike in the number of transactions we started getting and we've maintained that for 2 weeks. We need to go back and look at what got pushed into production 2 weeks ago. Right, because this has changed the dynamic of things. Getting more transactions isn't always bad, right? But you just need to be aware of when the ups and downs are coming, right? And find those peaks and valleys. If you're a nerd and or a stats nerd or something like that, you can just graph everything or try to trend everything. If you haven't looked in the PG stat tables, most of the statistics information comes out of that, right? I would say probably since 8.3 and maybe even older versions, you can get number of selects, inserts, updates. You can look at like hot updates. There's other information in there, index scans and that kind of thing. All of that stuff is definitely good to have. You'll probably want to research it at times. Finding cases where, you know, like suddenly maybe somebody rolls out some code and the queries on it are fast individually. They do an index scan, right? You look at the explain plan, and it's what you want. But realizing suddenly that your index scans, you know, went from like a million a day to 10 million a day, you might not otherwise realize how much of a problem that is, right? Because it could be a loop in the query or something like that. So being able to go back and look at that over time, Postgres gives you all this information as a counter, but it has no way to tell you historically how that traffic has gone, right? So that's where you need to put it into another system like Cacti or something like that. You can definitely get the instant information out of Postgres, but to trend it over time, you need to put it in another system, right? Or build your own system in Postgres to do it. You can do that as well. Again, sort of underlying effects, looking for load spikes. Those are the classic cases where you should be worried about this. In some cases, I mean, you could put monitors on this to page you. If table scans go through the roof on an important table, I suppose, you know, you may want to know that. Probably I wouldn't monitor it that way. I would more just want to trend this stuff. Again, mostly for OLTP stuff and sort of the internet-facing stuff where you don't have control over the data that's coming in necessarily. Also, no endorsement of this book. I just thought it had a nice title. So, but the more you do this stuff, the more you'll start to play around with graphing in different systems. And some of them are good for doing a large-scale number of graphs, and other ones maybe, you know, not so easy to configure. So however you want that to be displayed or have that data available, is one thing. And a lot of this is you don't necessarily have to graph it all the time. If you just store the data someplace where you could then feed it into a graphing system, that's good as well, right? But if you're not collecting it over time, you don't have the ability to go back and see what had happened. So, you know, collect it over time and be able to go back and query on it. The free space map. How many people here are running 8.3 or less? So, a number of you. And you all look really happy about that as well. So this is a really bad thing in older systems. And honestly, we still have A3 boxes as well, so I should raise my hand for that. We have older ones as well. If you haven't been bitten by a free space map, that's good. Potentially, you just don't know that you have been bitten by it, though. What the free space map does, basically, is it tracks unused space in the database, right? And that is basically like you do a bunch of updates. You run a vacuum updates some system tables to say, you know, these tables have this much free space in them. As you do more vacuuming, go ahead and clean this up or reuse it and right, keep your system running optimally in theory. The biggest problem that we found is that there are two settings in the PostgreSQL.conf, which are FSM max pages and FSM relations. The pages one is usually the bigger problem. The default on relations is 1,000, so most people don't end up with 1,000 tables or more in their database. If you're doing heavy partitioning, though, watch out, because that's where those people usually get bit, right? You start cranking out a new partition every day, and yeah, it's 3 years before you'll actually have more than 1,000, but you know, you'll do it on another table, and now you're down to like a year and a half. And unless you're switching jobs really rapidly, this could eventually get you. The pages one, though, is sort of more insidious, right? Because pages is really a bad measurement of how anyone thinks of their data, right? You usually think of it as number of rows in a table or maybe size of the entire table, but not how many pages do I have in my table, right? I couldn't tell you that on any system I run without going and looking it up. So knowing how to set that measurement, I forget what the default is because the default is too low, and I set it up as soon as I install any new system, right? How big it needs to be is definitely dependent on size of your database and how much data churn you have. The larger the database and the more data churn, the larger it has to be. The worst part about it is in order to change it, you have to restart the database. So if you're on systems where people don't like you just randomly restarting the database to change configurations, you've got to be, you know, ahead of the curve and plan that stuff out. So part of the question might be here, so what happens if I don't actually monitor this, or maybe I don't care, or you know, what's happening to me right now because I've never heard of this? If you're not paying attention and you go over these limits, Postgres doesn't usually tell you and doesn't really care. It'll just start losing track of tables and indexes that you have that are bloated, and they could really use some help from vacuum, right? You'll see the table and index bloat starting to creep in. This causes queries to get slower and all bad things that come from that, right? Often the restart is a really painless way, right? You just bump this limit up and you wouldn't have any problems. It's definitely less painful than, oh, now I have to like cluster a bunch of tables to get rid of the bloat. So luckily in 8.4 and beyond, not a problem anymore. They've changed the way this is implemented. So if you're one of the lucky ones that are doing that, you're good to go. But anyone on an older system that hasn't looked at this should definitely, you know, go take a look right now. The poor way to see if you're being bothered by this is to go on like the Postgres database or maybe like template one, run a vacuum verbose, and then at the end of that output, it'll say, you know, oh, your free space settings are this, and they really should be this, which is some much larger number. Probably if you get that message, what it really should be is probably twice whatever it tells you it should be. Right, it's really bad at estimating that out. So if you see that, one, you know you have bloat and need to go look at that. But two, you also need to start, you know, do a restart really soon to bump that configuration parameter up. Again, medium to large systems is where this comes into play. They tend to have enough dirty pages to get over the defaults, especially if you have high update or a lot of data churn in your database. That'll do it as well. If you're doing tricks like truncating instead of deleting and things like that, that can buy you some time, but when you start to get to the limits, it won't, you know, it won't get you out of that mess. So definitely keep an eye on this. We page on this one. I have seen people track usage over time so that you can project out better, you know, what should I set this to when I have to do the restart. You can watch how quickly you're eating through pages. But we will page on this. You know, I think we usually set it like probably 95%. if you don't know percentages and you're writing a system like this, I will once again say, go look at Check Postgres. The defaults in there are usually pretty good. They're set by, you know, somebody who wrote the patch to say, I need to monitor this, and put the code in and said, this is what we set our defaults at, and there'll be some general agreement. So I would say use those defaults if you don't have a better idea. Auto vacuum max freeze age. So this is another one that not really friendly and not well understood. Basically, for those who don't know about auto vacuum max freeze age, it's a way that Postgres uses to make sure that all tables get vacuumed within the system before you get to XID wraparound, right? That is regardless of actual update activity on the table, right? That's just the way that Postgres works. It has a limited number of transactions, which is not a very small number necessarily, but before every table in the system needs to get vacuumed, right? The reason why this becomes a problem is, again, I will say that I think the default is probably too low. I always bump it up when I install a new system. Even on smaller systems, I'll bump it up. It's kept it where it's at to limit the size of C-log on a system, right? I think if you set this to like whatever its maximum is, your C-log goes to, I want to say, 500 megabytes. That can be actually an excessive amount of space for some people, but most people have, you know, tens of gigabytes of disk space, and they can afford that, so you can usually crank this up quite a bit. The reason why I really don't like this and where it's bitten me is once you hit this level, anything that hasn't been vacuumed based on this number will now start to get a vacuum no matter what, right? If you have a lot of tables that were never vacuumed because they don't have a lot of update activity, there's not a lot of data churn going on, you'll see these vacuums come in and you'll get I/O spikes and sort of a constant I/O use, right? It won't be I'm doing one table every now and then. It's I've got three auto vacuum processes going and they just all start trying to vacuum stuff. And you know that could be in the middle of the day or whenever, so you'll definitely see an I/O impact. There can also be locking issues around. You know, a lot of times these cases are I have this really large table of like archive data. We don't really update it very much. Now I'm going to vacuum it, and that vacuum is going to kick off and take like 24 hours. So if I was planning to do something there, I can run into a problem, especially in like partition cases where you want to like make new partitions and it's trying to get exclusive locks on the partition chain, but you're doing this like 24-hour vacuum. Again, high transaction per second systems definitely have this problem because they chew through the number of transactions that the system can handle in a much more quicker fashion. OL2P, again, usually being the case with that. PG-dump can also have an issue. Not PG-dump itself, but if you've done like a PG-dump to get from one machine to another, again, and you have tables where there's not a lot of data churn, those tables go into the new system and they've never been vacuumed. Right, and this is the classic where I've seen, you know, people have imported a bunch of data. Those tables don't ever get vacuumed, don't need to get vacuumed because they're not adding or modifying that data. But it turns out once they hit max freeze age, now Postgres just starts vacuuming everything. Right, so if you've gone through that type of an upgrade, right, because coincidentally that's our upgrade process, this can hit you somewhere down the line, and it's never an immediate problem. Right, it takes a while to get to that transaction limit. But eventually it will hit you, you know, like 2 in the morning on like Friday night when you're at the pub, and you know, that's just bad. So definitely take a look at this. This is still, you know, this parameter is still around. It's in 9. So again, I always bump up the defaults to something larger. I think I usually probably put it around 1 billion. I think the default is like 200,000 or something along those lines. Or 200 million, I'm sorry. I think the default's 200 million. I usually crank it up to like a billion, but I've gone even higher on some systems just because, you know, I'm trying to avoid the problem in general. But then again, we also page on this because we want to know ahead of time if we need to do some work, if we need to schedule, you know, like a vacuum in the early morning to take care of some tables that are going to be approaching this limit when we have low I/O on the system overall.
Yep. You're saying you page on it approaching needing.
Yes. So, and actually, that was it's a good point to raise because on the Check Postgres list, there was actually some discussion of this. I think, so I originally put the patch in for this and said, like, here it is, and here's my defaults, and this is what we use. And then somebody came along and said, well, you'll always get false positives because it will page and tell you, like, you're approaching this, but you won't have hit it yet. And the argument is, well, that's the point, right? You need to know before you get to this limit, because once you hit the limit, things are getting vacuumed, and you're basically, you know, restart would actually be the only way to stop that, right? You can't turn off auto vacuum at that point, because this is, you know, vacuum for transaction wraparound. So it will ignore all your auto vacuum settings. The only thing you can do is restart the database, you know, and while it's down, change this parameter and put it higher. That will buy you more time. So, we do the alerts, and we do them, I think, usually at about 85%. Again, it'll be dependent on size of data and how much churn you think you have. Yep. $2 billion is pretty high.
Yeah, because then when it actually hit that, it never had time.
Right.
Before it hit $2 billion and failed outright. But so I have my mind about $1 billion. But you say you page. When you page, what do you? So you hit page and you find out this is a potential problem. What do you do about it?
So the what I would normally do is I want to go in and look and see how many tables this is going to affect. Right? Is it one random table that is approaching, and then you don't care? Right, and then you're like, why am I paging on this? But if you go look and you can see, like, oh, I've got dozens of tables that are going to hit this, and this is where it's sort of a judgment call on how early a notification do you need. And actually, I would say some of these systems are actually pretty smart, where you can say, you know, only page me during business hours or something like that, which is debatable as a philosophical point if that's a good page. But, you know, usually the case is I need to vacuum these tables, and I need to do it at a specific time. Right, so it's just set up like a cron job or some kind of script to go in and vacuum the tables that are in question.
So you're just trying to control
the right, you're trying to control the I/O spike that you might hit, or make sure no other process is going to go on when this is going to go off. Right, like that will conflict with that. Yep.
Is this a parameter that is specific to a table?
No, this is cluster wide. That is, right, that's per table, right? So the setting is cluster-wide. Don't let any table get over this limit, and then you can look at each table to figure out, you know, where exactly you are in this. At least true as of 8.3. I believe in 8.2, you actually can't tell table-wise. You can only tell database-wise. I might be off by a version there, going the older. So in 8.2, you can tell, okay, so 8.1 is where you can't really tell per table, but by 8.2, then you can tell per table where it is. Right, as I said, so first thing is go look and see, you know, I think if you use the Nagios alert, I think it will tell you which table is actually at that limit, but you need to go look it up and see, you know, how many, because it'll only tell you the first one, and there could be multiples there. While I'm running queries. These ones get a little more debatable on if you need to page on these kinds of things. I would say it starts to become very workload dependent. One of the problems, though, that you'll see is, right, so Postgres, you can have queries and you tune your system and you get all running in production, but data will change over time, and then if you have auto vacuum going, the analytics are changing over time, and a query plan can flip, and now suddenly a query that was fast starts to become slow for some reason, right? So that's sort of one issue that you'll see this crop up in systems, right? You can look in PGStat activity to find long-running queries. And that's actually where most of these checks look, is they look in PGStat activity to figure out, you know, what's the longest running query? Has it gone over this duration? And it's sort of an SLA thing versus a general system maintenance, right? On the SLA side, if you need all your queries to respond, you know, within 2 seconds, then having something that's going to tell you, like, oh, I've got queries now that are, you know, at 5 seconds, that's bad. You know, that might be important enough that you need to get an alert on that kind of a thing. Right. If it's more, you know, I've got issues where if this query is going to run for an hour on the system and I'm trying to do vacuums to recover space, right, that'll cause some issues. Sometimes that's okay because you actually need to run the query and it really needs to take an hour. In other places, that might not be okay. Right. So it's just sort of being aware of what your obligations are and what your system has to do. Yep. So if in some other database systems, when you explain a query, you have the ability to actually freeze the plan it's going to use. And yeah, so you can force that plan to be used forever no matter what. The closest thing in Postgres would be probably doing like a SQL function, actually, right, where it'll actually generate a plan when you run the SQL and reuse that plan on some level. Right? But it's certainly not I run this query, I freeze the plan, and anyone that tries to run this query going on further will use this exact same plan. Preparing a query is similar, right? So it just depends on if every connection comes in, prepares, and then disconnects, right? So you're not freezing it permanently. The more advanced systems, you can freeze it at the database level, and then any connection that comes in will reuse it. There's debates on if that's a good thing or not, right? Because sometimes the plan should change, and you've frozen it to not change. But in general, you know, it's definitely a trick where, you know, it's always a missing feature when the plan flips and is now bad, right? Then you wish you had it. So, you know, who's going to get bit by this? If you're doing active data collection, you know, this type of thing can happen. If you have like a BI guy that's going to occasionally go on and run a system and run a long query, it can pop up. I like to say if you let developers write queries, then this can happen as well. A lot of this also depends on how, you know, you're pushing code out to production. If people are testing on small systems that aren't, you know, actually in relation to what you're really doing in production, it may look fast on the system they're running it on, but it will not be in production. So being aware of that is you know, a good thing. Again, whether you need to get paged on this or maybe, hey, just send me an email every time you see a query that's running this long, and then I'll respond to those as necessary. That's sort of up to you and how your business is working. Idle transactions. This one's pretty similar to long-running queries. It's a little trickier in that here the case is usually there's a begin, possibly some work occurs, and then the client goes and does whatever it does, which apparently is not talk to Postgres anymore, and the connection just sits there. If you look in pgstat activity, you'll see these, and the current query will say idle in transaction. Right? So it's pretty easy to pick these out. It's kind of bad, right? It can cause issues for vacuums. If you have this idle transaction going on and vacuum's trying to clean up space, it will look at that and say, well, this guy, you know, according to database semantics, he should still be able to see these rows. I can't get rid of them. The other issue can be like connections that are holding memory. If they do a really large query and then they get all that data back and now they're processing it in the application and they haven't closed the connection, that memory is still being held, right, for the connection process. Ideally, they would close the connection once they get the data and then go do their processing, but I don't always see applications written that way, so you know, it just happens. It's kind of a problem for everybody. How bad of a problem it is, again, depends on workloads and SLAs and that kind of thing. If for some reason you're not running like auto vacuum, it's less of an issue, actually, right? Because one of the big problems is it'll conflict with vacuum. It's still generally good to know that this is going on. If you think about from a client application perspective, if you're holding these connections open, idle, and transaction, and you don't actually need them to be, you're taking up connection slots in your database, and we have a hard limit on connection slots, so this could cascade into a larger problem if left unchecked, right? I haven't actually figured out how you can convince developers to fix this if it's their problem, but that doesn't mean you don't want to know that it's a problem. So that's extra magic, I guess. Sequence limits. I've often argued in the past that you don't actually need to care about this. If you set your sequences up and it's 2 billion, that's usually a really big number that won't affect anyone. I like to say if you have 2 billion customers, this probably isn't your biggest problem. However, if you had 2 billion customers, this may not be your biggest problem, but it would actually be a real problem, depending on how you set your system up. Basically, the idea here is that, right, sequences are limited to some number. And usually it's around 2 billion if you just do the default stuff. So you need to keep an eye on, you know, how quickly you're churning through these things. It is non-transactional, so you can actually get to 2 billion without having 2 billion customers. It's a good retort to my argument. If for some reason you're taking these, you know, sequence values and then, you know, they're not always getting put into a table, it's not always stored, things are rolled back or whatever. If you reach the limit on the sequence, it breaks your inserts, which will almost undoubtedly break your application, and that's probably going to be a bad thing. I find it mostly on heavy insert systems. So if you either don't use sequences, which would be odd, or you're not doing a lot of heavy inserts, maybe you know you're mostly select only and you don't insert a lot of data, maybe not so much of a problem. You don't have to worry about it. But if you're doing stuff where there's heavy inserts, or again, you know, things are being inserted, like say you're setting up a tagging system, so it's as much as people want to tag stuff, you just get that many inserts and they all get an ID. Those are the types of scenarios where you can start blowing through these. And again, it's probably longer running systems, right? Something that's been up for a few years where you're really going to start hitting this. You can set sequences to higher amounts. Most people don't do it because they want to use integers and save a little space. I will not preach one way or the other whether that's good or bad. It can be good for some people, and 2 billion usually is actually enough for most people. But it's not; it doesn't hurt to monitor this. I mean, we monitor this on most of our system.
It is a quarter of the population of the world.
Pardon?
It is a quarter of the population of the world.
Yes. So it's almost everybody online.
Yep. The way you get that, you increase the limit?
So the way you fix it is tricky, right? In theory, you can just change the limit on the sequence, but probably you've set it up as an integer data type, so you can't actually accept the values that you will get beyond, which means you need to change the data type of the column, which probably means you have to lock the table and rewrite all the data. And if your problem is that you had 2 billion rows in the table, you are really in trouble. Right? So this is why it's kind of good to know ahead of time. Probably not because you can fix it, but you can at least get your resume out on Monster and get out of there before they try to fix this. Right? So, whichever way works to solve your problem. Wraparound. This is also really bad. This is wraparound man. Actually, Postgres at this point is pretty good about not having this problem, which I can only say because my boss is not in the room, and we just had this problem on a system, I guess it's an 8.2 system, about 3 weeks ago. Right, so again, you have to vacuum every table in around 2 billion transactions in Postgres. If you don't do that, it's not a big deal. It's only catastrophic data loss, right? So, so that's usually bad for most people. So you kind of need to keep an eye on this. Postgres will attempt to keep you from having this problem, but the way that it really prevents that is it shuts the database down, right? That does present another problem. So being aware how close you are to wraparound and making sure tables are getting vacuumed is something you have to watch for, right? That's pretty much everyone. Now, how long it takes you to get through 2 billion transactions, again, maybe that's a long time. Because you saw the transaction slide and you're now trending that information, because you've all set that up during the course of this talk, you can project and see how much of a problem this is for you. Right? But if you're not paying attention and you do get to this, database is going to shut down. You have to start in standalone mode. You have to now vacuum tables and have downtime during that. And that's all bad. Right? First-hand experience that we just had that problem on some systems a couple weeks ago. I would say usually you don't run into this problem on newer systems because you have auto-vacuum with multiple workers. If you've been paying attention at all, you're making sure things are getting auto-vacuumed, especially with like auto-vacuum max freeze age. But the older the system, the more likely you could get bit by this. Yep.
And this is even on completely read-only tables?
Yes, completely read-only tables. So I think if you have vacuum-freezed all of your tables and you go through wraparound, you would actually be okay. But most people don't actually ever do that, so.
But it does get done automatically after 200 million transactions.
So, right, it all depends on how you set up your settings, right? So, gentleman in the back saying, I set my max freeze age to 2 billion, which is probably too high, he's likely to get to wraparound time, right? So it just depends on workload and that kind of thing. A final or close to final note, another thing to check that I've gotten to be a big fan of is just monitoring the settings in your database. The big problem that I've found, or a couple of them, one thing is that PostgreSQL.conf doesn't actually reflect the reality of what's going on in your database. Right? You can go in and modify the file, and you can even have somebody do reload and not realize something they changed was a restart-only parameter, and now they haven't actually changed any of the config settings. If you go in and look at the file and assume that that's what the database is doing, you'll be looking at the wrong settings, right? So you kind of need to verify things within the database when that happens. Places where this crops up, even in fairly well-maintained shops, are if you're just doing a temporary change to deal with an issue and then you don't go back and change it, or for some reason you go back and you change it in the file but you don't do a restart or whatever it takes to set it back to what it was. That can happen to anybody. So being a little diligent and having a system in place to keep track of that is definitely a good idea. I've seen a couple of different systems. Some copy the data from, you know, within the settings table within Postgres, and they do like checksums on it. That's the way that the check Postgres script monitors it. You can also have something where just, you know, have Subversion check in your conf files anytime they've changed and have that email out, you know, the diff of the file whenever that happens. Either of those are fine. It's not really about how you get notified, but have a record of when things have been changed and, you know, the ability to see that somebody's changing something. Yep. DC Keeper. No.
DC Keeper is a package runs on most Linux and other systems, and it basically checks all your config files with DTC into Git, Bazaar, whatever you like.
Okay.
And if you install package, it also does that. So you get the default settings, and so you have a complete history on the system.
There you go.
And perfect for that.
Yeah, if you're using something, I would say like Puppet or Chef probably can do that as well. So depending on how you set that up, if you actually put your configs in Etsy, then that's good. Not everyone does that, but did you other directories? Okay, cool. So that's good. So any of those systems to me is fine. It's a matter of I want the record that somebody has changed something. So if I didn't know anyone was going to be changing something, and I see some, you know, I'm being made aware of that. But then also being able to go back and make sure things are getting set back when necessary. So. That's mostly it. Thanks to PGCon. Thanks to the PG community, especially the folks around Check Postgres. Like I said, there's been a lot of work put into that script. I would recommend anyone that's going to put something together to like either use that or crib from that, because both of those are good solutions. If you have questions or specifics about this and you want to ask me questions, send me an email or whatever. I'll post these slides up so you can see them again. And there's going to be this really awesome video of this talk. That I'm sure you will all enjoy because it was great. So that'll be posted somewhere, I'm pretty sure. So there you go. So that's it.